At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Over the course of this year, the team behind Backroads Lore have released three fantastic issues that cover a plethora of unusual, peculiar, and strange cases. As Halloween creeps ever closer, David Weatherly, Chad Lewis, and Kevin Lee Nelson join me to discuss the fourth and fifth issues, Strange Harvest and The Van Meter Visitor, 1903 and beyond. But before we hear from the paranormal titans behind the Backroads Lore series, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes, and thank you to each and every one of you that support me in the show with your contributions. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit our website, mysteriesandmonsters.com. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. You can get your hands on some Mysteries and Monsters exclusive merchandise via the site on TeePublic, links in the show notes as well. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Spooky scarecrows, lost vampires, cryptids, and tales of tainted treats await us in the annals of the Backroads Lore series. Hoping that three of the most passionate, diligent, and engaging researchers would work together is often a dream we all aspire to in this field. However, this year, we've been spoilt by the quarterly releases of the wonderful Backroads Lore series of books from a trinity of paranormal powerhouses, David Weatherly, Chad Lewis, and Kevin Lee Nelson. And I am delighted to welcome all three on this week's episode, prior to their potential eating at this year's Van Meter Festival in Iowa. Gentlemen, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thanks, Paul.
It's great to be back, Paul.
Chad's being serious about not speaking at all.
Thank you for having me back for my record-breaking 10th appearance on the show. Broke my own record of 9.
You have. Edged ahead. And I wondered, I thought, why is he... Because he asked me this earlier on, chaps. And I think it was just to make sure he got more appearances than you, David.
Has he had?
I'm so far above the competition. I'm competing with myself. Like, I'm trying to break my own records. That's where I'm at.
Well, this is Kevin's third appearance. David, this is your 9th, and Chad has sneaked ahead of you to 10 by creating this. So he's only one ahead of you at the moment, sir.
Okay.
Well, I have to say, as I was joking with Chad earlier, sometimes you wonder when a project like this is mooted, and you hope, having spoken to you all and knowing your strengths and the length and breadth of your knowledge in a variety of fields over the years, that you would come together and give us something. To have now got to the point of the end of this year where you've come up to releasing 4 separate editions of this wonderful Backroads Lore collections that you're working on, are you surprised how well it seems to have gelled, despite the fact that you're all obviously friends and you've worked together previously, that this series has both been a personal and professional success, it would seem?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I pretty much expected it, to be honest. And this is something that was kind of brewing for a long time, actually, because the three of us had spoken and kicked around some ideas. And you know, we're all incredibly busy in the field. And as these things happen, you know, what would happen is that periodically we would touch base and we would just throw some ideas back and forth. And there were good ideas, and some of them are, you know, probably living through Backrow's lore in some way ultimately. But what happened, I don't know if we've ever even told the inception story for this. So it kind of came about in some ways very spontaneous. All three of us were speaking at the Dogman conference in Texas a year ago Labor Day. So it had been September 23. And I had sort of, I hadn't talked to these guys about this, but I had kicked around some different ideas just with my, you know, my own stream of thought, somewhat inspired by the whole Wood Knox series that I did, but I really wanted to go well beyond that. And I don't know, there was this interesting moment at the Dogman Festival. Our tables were kind of catty-cornered from each other. And Chad and Kevin are sitting there with their table, and they have this Backrow's Lore banner, because the Backrow's Lore name they had for some time previous. And I'm just kind of sitting there looking at this banner, and it just, this whole idea just kind of started flooding out. And I sat there for a few minutes, honestly, because I was like, I don't know exactly what these guys are doing with Backrow's Lore and how they're going to react to this. But I thought, you know, what the hell? So I walked over and I pitched this very bare bones idea to these guys. I said, you know, we've talked about doing something together for a long time. I said, and I asked them up front what they were doing with Backrow's Lore. And, you know, I guess they can kind of fill you in on that. But they were both just kind of standing there listening to me for a few minutes. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And then afterwards, I mean, they were just completely, I think, excited about it. So the rest of the conference, we're all running back and forth between each other's tables. And it all came out in a flurry between the three of us. And we right away had the concept, you know, it's like, okay, this is the format. This is, you know, how often we're going to publish. This is, you know, here's some basic ideas. And then we started pitching out different themes. Ultimately, we came up with a theme that I'm not sure if it really, it might have eluded some people. You know, the first one we called it Beyond the Blacktop, and the concept was really something that went to the heart of Backrow's Lore. It was all things that related to going well out of the city, you know, well off the beaten path. And then we had so many ideas, you know, beyond that, which some of them you've seen already. There's Bizarre Encounters was the second one, and then Weird Wild West. We just dropped the cover for number four, which is Strange Harvest. It's a Halloween edition, essentially. It's a lot of autumn-themed lore. But I should point something out, Paul. We have actually slipped in an extra edition on you, because we're actually publishing five this year. Hmm. We've done a special edition of Backrow's Lore that is exclusively about the Van Meter Visitor, and that will debut this coming weekend at the Van Meter Visitor Festival.
I suppose, Kevin and Chad, then, when David's come over to you, did you think that all your paydays had come at once? You thought this is the idea that we've been waiting for ages? And it just, because for me, I think looking from the outside, you three working together just makes perfect sense for me.
Well, and I think you hit the nail on the head there. So for a long time, you know, we've Chad and I have kind of bounced ideas around, like, you know, how do we want to express Backrow's Lore? Because really, Backrow's Lore has been around for over 20 years as sort of this loose collective of like-minded people. I mean, it includes Noah Voss. It used to include Linda Godfrey, who, of course, is now passed. You know, a lot of people from our neck of the woods that we would collaborate with and share information, share research with, you know, because we weren't in competition with each other. You know, we didn't look at it that way. We looked at it as this, you know, collecting all this material out there and folklore and stories, you know, for the betterment of society and culture in general. But we were kind of selective about who we wanted to work with, because, you know, I mean, not everyone works great together either. professionally or just in their overall outlook and how they perceive these things. You know, some people look at these legends in a way of just wanting to prove or disprove, you know, sort of that ghost hunter's approach where they're like, I'm just out to prove that Bigfoot exists, or I'm out to prove that UFOs exist. And they have these definite kind of black and white or hardline attitudes on things. Whereas we've kind of always approached it as we've kind of stepped back to where we're not really out there to prove or disprove legends and lore necessarily. I mean, if we can, great. But in general, we're just trying to collect these stories and preserve them so that they don't vanish. Because a lot of these stories are just, you know, a generation away from disappearing if they're not written down, if they're not shared. And so we kind of wanted to find like-minded people that were on the same page that would approach the subjects in a way that works well together. And of course, when David approached us at that conference he mentioned, you know, right away we're like, oh, this is a perfect match. You know, David is on the level with us. You know, we have similar ideas on these things. So, you know, and it's not like we're trying to create any kind of groupthink per se. I mean, we're definitely open and we all have our own little tweaks and versions of how we approach things. But overall, you know, we have a very similar and respective approach on that material.
I mean, for you, Chad, as Kevin refers to there, then obviously you're probably renowned for sort of co-working with people. David's obviously done some books as well in the past with people, and you obviously work with Kevin quite substantially as well, both in print and in the field, as it were, when you're both attempting to kill off Joe Turi. And so I suppose for you, this is just a continuation of all the research you guys have been doing in your separate fields, really.
It really was. What excited me so much about the concept is that we all had these ideas of folklore articles and research that wouldn't fit into their own book. They might not even necessarily fit into a chapter of a book. There'd be no other place to put this cool stuff, but in this book project where in one of the previous ones, I did an article looking at if the old lumberjacks of the Northwoods ever encountered Bigfoot, where you're just not going to put those thought pieces anywhere else in a book, even a chapter on its own. So I was really excited to let's really have fun with this and explore some ideas that never get talked about.
I think as well, as Kevin alluded to as well, the one thing that's always struck me about the work that you all do is the fact that you've got a real love of history and folklore, and you continue to value its importance even in the modern age. And as you mentioned, Kevin, it's a generational away from disappearing some of this. And I think these days, especially here in the UK and obviously amongst yourself and some other members of the Fortean community out there, there seems to be a real drive that we've got to sort of preserve these stories, these experiences, these histories from all over the place as much as we can, because we can already see things starting to fall away, or perhaps people connected with certain events are no longer with us. I mean, obviously, we've just the Mothman Festival is in full swing, or full flap, as some may say. And so we're getting to a point where most of those key witnesses are reaching the end of their journey on this planet, it would seem. And therefore, we're going to get to a point where we're not going to have the first-hand witnesses from that original situation in the 60s. And when we look at some of these other ones, obviously, as the Van Meter monster is approaching us, it's 120 years ago. So there's no chance of anybody being around. But you've still got that aspect that you might have a great-grandchild who remembers those kind of incidents. And therefore, a project such as Bat Road's Law, for me, is both perfect sense and also the fact that it's vitally important for American cultural folklore, is it not?
I would agree. I mean, especially in America, where, you know, so much in our culture is so disposable and fleeting. You know, people are into something or interested in something, and then they move on to the next thing. And, you know, like I said, if this isn't recorded or written down, you know, it's everyone's on to the next thing, and then it's just forgotten forever. So, and culture is, especially, and folklore is always shifting, it's always changing, and I think with the attention span and just how we're inundated with so much information these days, you know, we're pulling in things from every direction, that it's easy to overlook a lot of these stories. And you know, we talk to people and interview people about legends in their area, and a lot of times they're surprised that they're like, oh, I've lived here for 20 or 30 years and I've never heard this story from my own area. And they're shocked that we dug something up. And I think that just shows how, you know, in many ways, unlike the past, we're kind of disconnected from where we live these days. You know, it's a very mobile culture. People move around a lot, and unlike in the past. And so a lot of people aren't even aware of their own local legends. And so, you know, this is a way to preserve those things.
I think another aspect of that, too, of what Kevin is saying, is that, you know, in the past, 20 years or so, there's been a tremendous amount of interest in all things paranormal, you know, ghost hunting and UFOs and Bigfoot and so forth. But what I have noticed in particular, a good portion of the people who get involved in the field, I'm trying to think of a kind way to say this and not be completely disparaging. I think that a lot of people who get interested, they fall into a certain trap. You know, if they're interested in haunted locations, their big goal is to save X thousands of dollars so they can go ghost hunt at the most well-known, you know, haunted asylum or whatever it is, the place that's been on 30 television shows and that, you know, hundreds of people have been to. And a lot of those people are ignoring what's down the block. You know, it's like Kevin is saying, there is the forest for the trees adage. You know, they're so focused on, oh, well, this famous asylum is haunted and I need to go there. No, look at your local legends. Find out, you know, that abandoned house down on the corner might be abandoned for a very strange reason. You know, maybe it's not just that the people moved out or something. You know, there could be a weird legend there that people are starting to forget. And all of these fragments, you know, those are things that all of us associated with Backroads Lore were really dedicated to kind of digging those up and getting them out somewhere in print so that it doesn't die. And, you know, so that there's a record of these things somewhere.
And to kind of just build off of what David was just saying, you know, he's saying how, you know, a lot of people that get in this field have, you know, singular interests. You know, they'll be like, I'm into Bigfoot or I'm into UFOs. And that's really what they focus on. Part of what makes our group work well, and at least I hope that our readers enjoy Backroads Lore for this, is that we as writers and researchers have a very, very broad range of interests across the paranormal. You know, there's plenty of people that know more about Bigfoot and know more about UFOs than I do, because that's all they do. That's what they're into. But between the three of us, our interests are so broad that, you know, we can pretty much write well on any topic that you present that we can dig up. And so that's why we keep our topics diverse throughout Backroads Lore. And instead of just focusing on, you know, yet another Bigfoot book or yet another UFO book or ghost book or what have you.
And I like you that said there, David, in regards to the wonderful collaborations you had in the Woodknock series, which was a collection of wonderful essays from people all around the world, often shining lights on cases and creatures that probably didn't see much traction in the US Bigfoot field, really, David. And I think that's one of the strengths of the books, is that you have got other people's perceptions talking about these things. Whereas for a lot of people, when they get in, as Kevin refers to, they seem to be laser focused on a particular topic. And very much like you three, I'm exactly the same. I love it all. Ghosts, UFOs, monsters, strange encounters, coincidences. The minutiae of the Fortean is what keeps me fascinated by it. And so when you're doing a collaboration like this, because I know all three of you through the conversations I've had in the past, through reading your work, seeing how you go out in the field and what you do, and your reputations always precede you as three of the best out there easily, that this for me then would seem a very natural step, I think, based on what you were saying about Woodknocks, David, that you've now gone and said, right, well, this is what we need to start preserving. This is what we need to keep hold of. Because as we were saying before we started, before I moved to this particular part of Sheffield, I was not aware of the three ghosts that are supposed to be in this particular area, despite the fact of living less than half a mile away from all three of them. Till I moved here, and realized where I'd moved to and started walking around. I had no idea. And that is essentially on my doorstep. And even with the weirdness that I always try to look for, next door even, that I wasn't aware of it, and it was staring me straight in the face. So for you guys to now start doing this and pulling people's focus back to their own neighborhoods or their own woods or their own spooky house that everybody's forgotten, I think is vitally important. And it may seem the simplest idea in the world, but as you all think, everybody's looking 100 miles down the road rather than just turning around and saying, what's all this about here?
Yeah, that's true. And I think that, you know, there's another aspect to this, too, that I'll discuss briefly. And it's that, you know, when I first met these guys, I felt a very direct kinship with them. And, you know, the more we've all learned about each other, I think there's a very obvious reason for that. As Kevin said earlier, our approach is very similar. And, you know, there's tons of people in the field that write and, you know, do television shows and all these things. But a lot of them are armchair researchers. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, a lot of them stick to very limited number of cases or legends or whatever. And if that's their forte, that's fine. These two guys, I love the fact that, one, they've went out and beat the bushes for years, just like I have. I mean, this is how I started in the field. You know, back in the 70s, there wasn't, you know, the internet and social media and all these things to get 120 characters of information about something. Yeah. You know, you had to go interview people. You had to look around the areas. You had to go to the location. And I'm still a big advocate of that. If this is what you're interested in exploring, you know, I don't care if it's a 100-year-old case. Go to the location. See what's still there. You know, see, are there any family memories? You never know what you're going to find. But unfortunately, most researchers don't do that. Most are content to see what they can find, you know, on forums or internet searches and so forth. So to really dig deep is one thing in terms of research, but to go beyond that and dig into the actual location, that's, I have a huge amount of respect for somebody who does that. And both of these guys, you know, they've done that for years, like I said. So between that commonality and just our holistic approach to the field in general and our love of folklore and legends and everything else, and they're both good writers. So, you know, it's turned out to be a really good, yeah, it just completely makes sense. The collaboration just completely makes sense, I think. So I think we've really synchronized quite well in a short amount of time with these editions that we've done so far.
Mm. I suppose as well, it can be quite frustrating, like you refer to there, David. I've seen so many things that people have told me about on shows or on YouTube channels or in other podcasts about certain incidents that have occurred where I live. And strangely enough, yesterday I visited a local church near where I grew up that is notorious. If you look for it, you can find it. It's a place called St. Thomas's Church, which is in a little village next to the village I grew up in. And I remember about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, my partner was listening to a true crime podcast where they were talking about the events after this. And I was listening to it and I was just like, well, that's wrong. No, that didn't happen. No, that's not true. No. And I was so infuriated by the end of this podcast that I'd never heard before because they got everything wrong. But I've known where this place is since I discovered this case, I don't know, 15 years ago. And then when I spoke to my mother about it, she said, well, we spoke about it when you were a child because something had happened and this person was in the news again. And so that yesterday was the first time I've ever been there in 50 odd years. Just to go and say, right, I've finally been here. And when I went, I realized it wasn't where I thought it was. I didn't even know there was a church where it was. And my great-grandparents are buried there. So I've had a connection to this particular location for all my life and never been aware of it until I've gone yesterday. So I know exactly what you mean, because it's crazy that it's taken me that long to go somewhere I've known where it is for 15 years.
You're talking about a church, Paul.
Yes.
So we're all having a moment of prayer there. So, you know. respectful silence, I guess.
I thought of a sad.
Dad probably fell asleep. And,
Chance just thinks the Wisconsin tradition of screwdrivers for breakfast, I think.
It's funny you mention that, because oftentimes, and Kevin, you had this experience with writing an article for Sinkhole Sam, that oftentimes these inaccuracies, these wrong facts or exaggerations or embellishments, they get repeated so often on the internet, on TV shows, on literature, that they become the source. When one mistake can snowball into 2 decades worth of people citing this, and it's all completely wrong just for the fact that nobody actually went there to look for themselves.
That's exactly right, Chad. You know, like, and that's the thing, is if you actually go there, you would see right away, like a lot of times it's clear as day that what you thought was, you know, a key part of the lore just is not correct at all. You know, it's apparent as soon as you go there.
Well, when I've spoken to you all previously, you've always spoken about the fact of trying to go as far back into the history as possible to see if you can find it. David, with your state books, you've got cases that go back to the late 19th century. Chad's, when you've done some of your research, I know when we were talking about some of the strange axe murders that you've covered and their sort of haunted reputation that sprung up since, how certain stories change and certain locations, the story has changed completely. I suppose the best example of that, I know I was speaking to another fellow Wisconsinite recently, Mike Bass, about his wonderful new book, Frightful Folklore of North America. And we were talking about the Goatman case. And obviously the one in Texas, how it started and how it is now, seem to be completely different versions of what happened. But it just shows you how that can happen very easily, because that seems to have spun out of control over the last 20 years. Whereas if you start to go back into sort of local Texan lore and Texan ghost books and things like that, there's a lot more reality based in the original event, as tragic as they were, that caused that particular story to start, rather than it's a half man, half goat monster that's running amok around that particular area these days.
But see, unfortunately, even a lot of modern researchers don't bother to do that. You know, that's I'm sometimes shocked by how a lot of people in this field are not very well read in terms of some of the legends they're researching. You know, you cannot count on the version that is online because, you know, the internet has become kind of like a massive game of telephone for some of these legends. You know, it's told and retold, and it, you know, there are embellishments, and, you know, it gets exaggerated. So it's always important, I think, to go back to at least the first reported sources that you can find. You know, in the old days, that meant for me going to these places called libraries that a lot of people don't know exist anymore. And, you know, sort of digging through their archives and microfiche, which a lot of people don't know what that is anymore. But, you know, sitting for hours having to go back through these old newspapers and things. That's one thing that the internet has been great for, is that a lot of the stuff is digitized now, but it still takes time. You know, you have to sit and go back and find the right keywords, the right dates and so forth. And a lot of times these stories, when you go back to the original, you know, the earliest report you can find, sometimes it's even weirder than what's being reported now. You know, I have found cases that, you know, people are now saying, oh, it was, you know, they saw Bigfoot. Well, no, when you go back and read the original story, it's much more bizarre than that. So, you know, they reported seeing something, but I don't know what in the world it was. So, again, yes, it's a matter of, you know, having a multi-pronged approach. You do have to go to the location, find any people, you know, any local legends or memories that might be around, but also go back to the original sources and see what you can dig up.
And I think we do need to make a distinction between folklore and tall tales. You know, like something like tall tales are meant to be embellished. You know, they're meant to be exaggerations and boasts. And, you know, like lumberjack stories are a perfect example of tall tales. But what we do with Backroads Lore, we all enjoy tall tales. And, you know, we touch on them a little bit here and there. But in general, we kind of stay away from that, because, you know, that's just something that intentionally is like what David alluded to, you know, the telephone game. You know, someone starts it, the next person that brings it up carries it on and adds a new chapter, adds a new twist on it, that kind of thing. You know, that's the kind of lore that's meant to evolve quickly and change. But what we tend to focus on is more the history-based folklore and getting to like the root of where it all started and where it began.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
I suppose when you were pulling articles together then for these first few issues of Backroads Lore that you've released so far, were you desperate to include a particular story or tale that you thought had been spun at way out of its origin, or a case of you wanted a particular story to be included in some of these earlier issues that you were very passionate about, that you thought they're the ones we're most in danger of losing? Because obviously there'll be some that are still quite well known, depending when you can go to certain areas, you'll know that everybody knows the particular story about this strange thing that happened in their town. Whereas, as you mentioned earlier, David, there are so many places where you can ask people about certain incidents. I mean, I remember, I'm sure we've spoken about this, Dave, but we were talking about that werewolf flap in the 70s. And loads of people these days had never heard of it, but it was in all the newspapers and everything. I mean, how you can forget a story about a werewolf destroying somebody's fence is right. Beyond me. But that's a prime example, isn't it?
Yeah.
So were there any particular stories that all three of you thought, right, we want to get these in as quickly as we can? I mean, obviously each issue is themed and you have an overarching sort of bookend that you're wanting your particular tales to be focused on in each particular issue so far. But is there anything that you're glad you've got out of the way as soon as possible during this early days of these collaborations?
Well, one that comes off the top of my head immediately would probably be the Steinthal monster case, which appears in volume 2, Bizarre Encounters. Because Chad and I have been talking about writing a booklet on that legend itself for years, but it's like Chad alluded to, you know, it's one of those stories where there's not a whole lot of meat on the bones. Like it's just fascinating and weird enough that people should know about it and it should be preserved, but it's not the kind of thing where you could fill an entire book with it, and that's also one of those legends that it's been written about very, very little. You know, there's just a couple articles here and there about that story. So we wanted to get that in. But as far as like how we choose to pick our stories, like you said, each volume has a particular general theme. But we also try to keep it fairly varied within that theme, because I'm sure you and your listeners, you know, probably can empathize with this. You know, it's back in like the 70s and 80s, a lot of books that you'd pick up on like folklore and weird stories and weird tales, you know, if they were on a theme on like ghosts or something or murders, you know, after you've read about a dozen stories that all kind of sound the same, where they're all, okay, so the ghost did this and the house was at the end of the street, you know, all those kind of start to sound the same after a while. So if you've got a 200-page book of just these kind of pieced together ghost stories, they just kind of all run together after a while. So that's why we wanted to intentionally keep things mixed up well and keep it varied enough to keep the reader's interest. So it's not just this laundry list of similar stories.
Well, yeah. I have a great example of that. Oh, sorry, David.
No, go ahead, Jeff. I'm going through.
Well, sorry, folks. I'm in the midst of celebrating my record-breaking 10th appearance on this podcast, so bear with me. But perfect example. For the first one, I included an article, the first Backroad Lore, I included an article on a place called Haunchyville. Mm. It's in Wisconsin, and the story is circus performers, little people, murdered their manager in Florida. They came to hide out in Wisconsin. They lived by a lake. Nobody knew what they were doing. Locals started spying on them. So they had to hire an average-sized man with a shotgun to protect Haunchyville. And for decades, teenagers and college age students would get trespassing ticket after trespassing ticket trying to find this place. But over the last several decades, this heavily forested area along a lake has slowly been developed. McMansion after McMansion has come tearing away the area. So I wanted to get that story into the first one, because in another decade or so, the legend of Haunchivo will probably be gone, because the forest in which they are said to live and eternally bother people, that will be wiped out. It will be gone. So if people aren't visiting now, they won't have a chance in the future. So that's exactly what we were going for in the first Backroads lore.
Yeah, and I had a similar one for the first volume as well, except that it had somewhat of personal connection. And I wrote a piece about the Hebron ghost light. And this is just a fascinating case from a little town called Hebron, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore. It's very close to Salisbury, but, you know, it's one of those areas, like Chad said, it's being developed. And, you know, not a whole lot of people in Hebron know about this legend anymore. But I had family that was there in the 1950s when this was happening. And it was just this crazy kind of intense period where people were encountering this ghost light on this remote road, and it got all kinds of media attention. You know, it was in the national news. Scientists came out to study it, but at one point police officers had a high-speed chase trying to catch this thing. You know, I have family that told me stories about local guys who would try to solve this ghost light. They thought it was a hoax, so they would park facing each other at opposite ends of the road and then basically play chicken with this ghost light in the middle, which of course would, you know, vanish and almost cause them to have a collision. So, you know, it's this intense, just crazy story. And now it's in some ways forgotten. It's shown up in a few books here and there, you know, in small passage. But again, it's something, you know, like Kevin was talking about, something that I had thought about doing, you know, just a whole little booklet on, but there's just not a whole lot, and it needed to be out there, and Backroads Lore proved to be the perfect place for that.
I think, as you all alluded to, that there are so many of these tales that you can't stretch it to a book, because as you say, there's very little meat to go on the bones. We may have sporadic reports, we could have a few newspaper stories, and that's about it. But it's intriguing, I think, that because you've now got this collaboration where you've got this outlet for these particular tales, it's saving them. And I think it's surprising as well, because often, whilst we may lament the fact that a lot of these could be disappearing, I'm thinking about something that happened over here a few years ago. We've got a village up in North Yorkshire called, delightfully known, this is probably one of the most English-named villages you guys have probably heard of, called Warren Percy. which is an old medieval village, which is essentially almost abandoned. There's a ruins of an old church, but there's like a few houses that have been built recently near it. But they were excavating these fields about 10 years ago, and they uncovered all these graves, and they thought, oh brilliant, we found some medieval graves, we'll dig it up, opened all the graves up, they'd all got bricks in the mounds. So then actually what they ended up uncovering was this vampire plague that had affected this particular village 600 years ago, that nobody, until these graves were rediscovered 10 years ago, nobody had any idea about at all. And it's there.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it sounds like a great story there to be told.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's vampire legend isn't that prevalent in old and British folklore. You can see a few stories that appeared post Bram Stoker. But in British folklore, there aren't many. I'm probably, I don't know, we've got the Crognan one, we've got Highgate, which is probably the most famous one, and a couple of others. But you can probably count the vampire stories in this country pre-1892 on one hand, no doubt. And so to find this village...
The ones that we know about.
Yeah, well, like, precisely, yeah. the ones that we know about, exactly, David. And this is a prime example. There's clearly a lot more of these, but we'd no idea about it because nobody wrote them down.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly the kind of things that we're targeting with this project, is to try to recover those types of things. And, you know, so that there's a record out there for people in the future to be able to study it.
I would imagine the latest edition, where you're doing the Halloween one, The Strange Harvest, and as with all of the covers, you've got some wonderful art from another mutual friend of ours, Sean. this one is an incredibly striking cover for the latest issue. Is it one of those situations where you guys have to kind of take a step back and think you're trying to put too much into a particular issue? Because I would imagine, looking from the outside in, there would probably be thousands of things you could probably focus on for such an edition as Strange Harvest.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The hardest thing for me with that edition was deciding on which legends I wanted to write about, you know, because there's so many great choices. And it's interesting, with each volume of Backroads Lore so far, we all kind of have a different approach, I guess, to how we think about what we're going to write about. And, you know, we have we get together fairly regularly. So we talk about, you know, pitch different ideas to each other. And, you know, so we're somewhat aware of, oh, yeah, Kevin's working on this, or, you know, Chad's thinking about doing this. But, you know, sometimes you have a great idea and it doesn't necessarily end up being the one that translates onto the page when it comes down to it. You decide to save it for another issue or another theme or something. So, you know, when it came time to do the Halloween one, it was tough. I had one that I knew I wanted to do because I wanted to do the history of the jack-o'-lantern and the folklore of pumpkins, because a lot of people don't know there's a lot of strange things about pumpkins, you know, and different lore that, again, it's scattered around, and it's, you know, you could argue that some of it's being lost just because it's not something you hear very frequently. A lot of people don't have a real clear sense of, you know, the origin of jack-o'-lanterns, you know, why they came about or how they came about. So, you know, for me, I think that, like I said, I think that was the toughest one to land on. Which articles do I use this time around? But what's cool is with each volume, all the articles end up complementing each other somehow. It's there's something going on, I think, on a subconscious level between the three of us, that we kind of work these issues together, and each one, it kind of hits all the right notes. And we don't necessarily talk about it, or we're not consciously aware necessarily that, oh, yeah, well, Chad's taking care of the, you know, a good monster article for this issue or anything. It just happens.
And Paul, I love this because as a student of folklore, Backroads Lore books are exactly what I would want to buy and want to devour. Mm. So much so that I do not read Kevin and David's articles beforehand. When we all submit them to our big file, I wait until the book is in my hand where I can learn as well. So I'm still getting some of that. I love the book so much that I'm waiting to devour it just like everybody else. And as you know, I was heavily influenced by Jerome Clark's Unexplained book when it came out. And it had the same concept that one night you could read about fairies, the next day crop circles or strange falls from the sky or mysterious creatures. And I just love that variety. And that's exactly what we're redoing with Backroads Lore, of that by the time you finish the volume, you might have touched on 15 different subjects, some you weren't even aware of or you didn't even know you'd be so interested in. So that's why I love Backroads Lore so much, because it's exactly the type of thing I would want.
And it's good that even for an experienced researcher like yourself, Chad, you still want to be surprised. And I think that's the thing that we all are so deeply fascinated about this, is that despite everything we've read about, all the places we've visited, all the people we've spoken to, there's always so much that none of us have ever come across, or stories that we've not discovered, or, as I'm sure you've all uncovered during expeditions and research, stories you thought you knew, but you didn't know the real story. And therefore, this is just a continuation of everything you guys have ever done.
Yeah, it really kind of is. And, you know, there's another influence there, too. When we initially had this conversation at the Dogman conference, one of the things that we had all loved for years was Fate magazine. I mean, I grew up on Fate magazine, and, you know, it was a big influence on me, you know, back in the 70s when I started. I would read that thing cover to cover. And although Fate is still published occasionally, it's just, you know, it's changed a lot. And there's not something out there in the field that is really doing what Fate magazine did, say, in the 70s or 80s, you know, or 60s, 70s, 80s. But, you know, when we discussed this, we were all kind of in agreement. Well, you know, we don't want to try to exactly replicate Fate magazine because we're living in a different time. You know, people aren't rushing and picking up magazines on the newsstand every month and things like that. So we wanted to sort of show that influence a little bit in the diversity of what's covered, because it's a reflection of who we all are in terms of what we love doing. But we want to take it a bit beyond that too, which I think we've done with, you know, more extensive articles and a deeper dive into some of these things that, say, with a monthly publication, you just can't do. You know, and it's, I mean, we've worked hard this year, you know, to put four volumes of this out. And some people might think, well, it's, you know, it's no big deal. But you have to bear in mind when something like Fate was being published, you know, you had very small columns and articles from people all over the country and abroad who were contributing. You know, this is three guys out, you know, tearing up the back roads and recording what they discover.
Yeah, and prior to Backroads Lore coming out, Chad and I had bounced around ideas of different ways to address these more minor legends. And we talked about doing a monograph series of just slim books, you know, somewhere between 50 and 80 pages, you know, on these legends that only have so much to them. But in retrospect, what we're doing now is so much better, because if you have individual booklets like that, it's going to take the right person and the right topic for number one, for it to sell and for it to have anyone's interest. You know, if we did a monograph book on the ghoul snake of Oxford Cemetery, I mean, like, yeah, it's going to bring in some people, but other people just be like, oh, that just sounds too weird. Or that's, I don't know anything about that, so I'm not going to buy it. You know, so it's not going to get as many people reading it as it would if it's bundled together with a lot of other very weird tales together. You know, that way, you know, you pick up the book, you glance over the table of contents, you might see half a dozen stories that pique your interest. And so you pick it up. And then as you read along through the book, you find out that, oh, there's actually 15 stories that actually are more interesting than I thought, that I wouldn't have known about otherwise. So it's, I think it's a more strategic way to get a lot of this information out there and preserve those legends better.
Yeah, it is an era I miss a great deal, as Chad mentioned, that you used to have these magazines or books where you would have a variety of topics. The only thing that's out there these days is 14 Times. And that, for better or for worse, tends to focus more on real things, or it goes into perhaps subjects that are more 14 and tends to sort of dive into mass hysteria things and often has a very sort of skeptical, it's balanced, but it's probably leans more towards the skeptic than the believer side, I think, on more occasions than not. And that's the same, even though as someone that's subscribed for it for 30 years, every month I do it the same way. I go to my favorite bits first, and then I start with the articles, and I end up finding something that, when I look at that table of contents at the beginning, I think, well, I'm not really interested in that. What's that going to learn me? But usually by the end of it, I've read it and I've gone, actually, yeah, I was just being stupid, as I do every month.
well, as David was saying, you know, that using that comparison to and bringing up Fate magazine,
yeah,
one of the things that maybe some of your listeners that haven't picked up an issue yet may be unaware is we also do a series of columns that are ongoing in every issue. So it's, you know, the same general theme, the same title of the column, and we have six columns that are ongoing. And then each issue or volume, we address it in a different way. You know, for instance, one of them is the mysterious outdoors. And so the way that we define that is anything that's a strange legend or tale that's from, you know, way in the backcountry or at like a summer camp or, you know, something that's very kind of out of the way, rural, in the wilderness kind of thing. You know, something that you have to hike to get to that legend. So, which, of course, a lot of those type legends are often not addressed because, you know, the ones you hear the most about are the ones that are most easily accessible for, you know, for a number of reasons. So that's kind of a tradition that we wanted to keep, sort of like Fate did and a lot of those magazines did back then, is these columns. So you can kind of come back and and have a reoccurring theme in each volume.
I mean, I'm interested to find out how the American state-by-state culture differs when it comes to something as normal as scarecrows, seeing as we're in that particular season, because I'm fascinated by scarecrows in general. I just find them... I don't find them creepy. I find them really intriguing. I think they're very interesting because it depends. Even something as simple or perhaps as unassuming as a scarecrow may appear, depending where you're from and where your family came from, how you view a scarecrow is going to be completely different. Because obviously here, famously in England, scarecrows came about because of the Black Death, and therefore we didn't have enough kids to pick crops, because before that, children used to just run around fields throwing stones at birds here, and that was what we did. After the Black Death, scarecrows became very fashionable because we didn't have enough kids to pick the crops. So that's how it started in the UK. But in Europe, they were used as kind of talismans in certain countries. Germany especially has a lot of witchcraft associations with their scarecrows. So when I look at the US and already knowing that certain states lean really hard into some of where their settlers came from, depending on what part of Europe or beyond that their populations were based upon, I'm really intrigued as to see that. I know for a fact already, probably, that Wisconsin's law towards scarecrows is going to be vastly different to how people in Texas think about them, and the same for Florida and California, wherever. There'll be, I would imagine, that each state's got a different version of it.
Paul, are you sure that you didn't get an advanced copy of Volume 4? Because there's an article on scarecrows in Volume 4 that's coming out. It's called Silent Sentinels, Scarecrow Lore and Traditions. And I touch on those exact points that you just brought up, but, you know, the differences between, you know, the British traditions and the mainland Europe traditions, and then focus on North American and even Central American scarecrow traditions, and even getting back to Native Americans had their own versions of scarecrows as well. And then I also touch upon, you know, around the world, how the Japanese did the same thing. But yeah, it's a whole article on scarecrow traditions, and even some of the more weirder ones, like how some of the Pennsylvania Dutch in eastern Pennsylvania, how they use scarecrows and some of their magical traditions that are associated with scarecrows.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Well, yeah, I mean, that surprises me. I mean, one of the things we have here in the UK, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of these, especially at this time of year, late September into October, but not particularly connected with Halloween, strangely enough, we have scarecrow festivals. And essentially, all the local villages or small towns will have competitions, and everybody makes their own scarecrows, and they have a judging panel after a particular period, like 3 weeks. You've all got 3 weeks to put your scarecrows in, and then they have a big judge, and people win a first, second, and third prize, and then they put them on display for the whole village. That happens from the south coast of England all the way into Wales, up into Scotland, over in Northern Ireland and Eire. It's all over the place, and it's quite funny. One of the best ones we have here is at a stately home called Rugley Hall, I think it is, which is in Lancashire. And they do a big theme. Like last year, it was myths and mysteries. This year, it's TV celebrity scarecrows. So we treat them with kind of a bit of comedy or a bit of light relief here. They don't have that fear factor associated with them. And especially for me, watching numerous bad horror films of the 80s and 90s, I know that there are certain places that seem to be terrified of a scarecrow coming to life.
Yeah, in the United States, it's kind of a different animal. I mean, it really depends on where you are. I mean, it's a big area, and traditions vary from state to state. Like you, we have scarecrow festivals all over the place. But one thing that's kind of evolved over time is that scarecrows have moved from being sort of a practical agrarian tool, you know, obviously for chasing away crows and protecting crops, to being more of an art form, more of a form of folk art in the form of a harvest figure. So you see scarecrows nowadays that are more, they're built out of things that are a bit more fleeting, you know, like pumpkin heads and things that are strictly tied to the season. I mean, you're not going to create a scarecrow in the beginning of spring with a pumpkin head, you know? So they're definitely a lot more tied to autumn than they ever used to be. And they're usually made with, you know, scraps of things or autumn produce is what you see mostly now. But again, it's kind of morphed into this form of folk art rather than being a practical tool.
Well, you only have to look at how the Japanese tend to bring these things out. There was that wonderful story a couple of years ago about them building that robotic wolf scarecrow that essentially looked like it could have been in RoboCop 2, I think, the way it was designed. I think it was designed to keep the bears away. But I think it just kept everybody else away as well, because it was just a very creepy looking thing. I think if you stumble across a large, gigantic, metallic wolf with glowing red eyes anywhere in the world, I think it's going to put the willies up you.
I would think so.
I'm intrigued to hear that there's some connection with indigenous culture as well, because I think sometimes we can overlook that they are used all around the world. I mean, as far as I know, I think the earliest example of scarecrows being used is in ancient Egypt, because I think they used to be inundated with plagues of quail, which is probably one of the least offensive birds I think most of us could think of, because they're quite small. You wouldn't think that they could do that damage. But I suppose if you get a large enough population of any creature coming onto your crops, be it rabbits or locusts or birds or whatever, it's going to cause an effect. And so even for people as far back as the ancient Egypt, they understood the need for such a thing without sort of attaching any kind of mystical process to it. For them, it was scaring birds away. So was that one of those things as well then, that the different tribes would have different reasons for creating a scarecrow? Or was there a standard simple reason for all of them using it, but different tribes attached different mysticisms to them?
Well, from what I've found, it's at least in earlier scarecrows, it's primarily all from a practical crop saving point of view. You know, like for instance, some of the tribes here would have these, they would create these scaffoldings or raised platforms, and then children and women would hang out on these platforms. And with noisemakers of various sorts, you know, they would bang things to keep birds away. So that was like what are called living scarecrows, which similar to what you were referring to in England, you know, prior to the Black Death, you know, with kids and old men that were sent out into the fields to make noise and throw rocks. So that's primarily what you see, you know, up until, you know, as long as you have those kind of people available, that's kind of what you do. It keeps them busy. It gives them something to do. But later when there's less hands around, say, that's when you have to build these effigies of people to scare away the birds. And then even that, you know, kind of, at least in America, you know, went away once they started, you know, treating seeds with various pesticides and things, so that the birds learned fairly quickly that if they eat the seeds, they get sick. And so they stopped doing that because, you know, crows aren't stupid. And so the actual necessity for a scarecrow doesn't really exist anymore. And again, and that's why it's moved over into being a form of folk art.
I suppose, David and Chad, as well, you will have probably stumbled across stories attached to scarecrows or certain locations over the years where certain places will believe that their local fields or woods are haunted by a scarecrow, or the scarecrow is the revenge of a wronged person from that particular area, or a crime has been committed. I'm answering my own question here. I doubt either of you would be surprised to find such a variation of beliefs on something as simple as a scarecrow, even in the modern era.
Definitely. Here in America, we have so many customs, traditions, rituals, superstitions. We've lost the meaning for a lot of them, that a lot of us will participate in these and not know why, just because the family has always done it, or it's always been the tradition in the community. For scarecrows, for instance, a lot of the Pennsylvania Dutch believe that if you didn't burn your scarecrow by Halloween, that it might come to life. It might actually curse you and be alive, and it would be something you would not want to battle. So we have all these customs and beliefs. And I think that's partly what we're trying to do in Backroads Lore, is to show the history, the folklore, sort fact from fiction of a lot of these customs and superstitions that in our busy everyday life, we just don't sit down and think, well, why do we put a scarecrow up in we don't have a farm? So I think that's very important work that we're doing in this field as well.
I suppose one of the other key stories, rumors, urban myths that comes up at this time of year all over the place is connected to trick-or-treating. Now, I suppose I'm quite fortunate because when I was a kid growing up, trick-or-treating just started here in the UK, sort of early 80s. E.T., I think, had a lot to do with it because it was such a big film. And one of the key scenes in that particular film is they obviously all go trick-or-treating with E.T. hiding in the basket. And so I remember even sort of being 10, 11, 12 years old, being told that people were putting razor blades in sweets, or they were all being poisoned, or people were putting drugs in them and trying to get people hooked on drugs, which is a unique way to be a drug dealer. I don't think there'll be much success there. But anyway, because you probably not remember which house had done it. So even if you wanted to go back to buy some drugs off, it still comes up. I mean, we have a couple every year where you've got this poison sweet scandal, or somebody will claim, this happens a lot these days, especially with social media, that somebody will claim that they found something in a sweet that's been given to their child. They very rarely go forwards to the police with this, which kind of sets the alarm bells off. Does it still occur in the US? Because I've seen it reported countless times, and when I was a kid, like I say, it started near enough immediately when it sort of kicked off here in the UK. Now obviously it's a big tradition. Kids everywhere around here all get dressed up and they all go out and do trick-or-treating, as you guys do.
Just did an article for our upcoming BRL4, Backroads Lore 4, Strange Harvest, on a trick in your treat, as it's called, and it explores the history and urban legend of tainted Halloween candy. The idea that you better not go outside your neighborhood because somebody's going to put a razor blade in the apple or a needle in a Snickers bar. And again, just taking a moment to think about, have you ever tried to put a razor blade in something without making an impact on it? It's nearly impossible to do. Every single story that we have of somebody being harmed or dying from a candy has been due to the hands of their own family, where it's a father who poisoned his child for the insurance money. It's a young boy who got into his uncle's heroin and they blamed it on the Halloween candy to cover up the quote unquote crime of the drugs being there. And all the cases that we do know of, dating back to at least the 1960s, late 50s, where there were people who put stuff in candy, but it wasn't fatal. We have a dentist who put a laxative in candy that he was upset that people were trick-or-treating, and a woman put rat poison, little pellets labeled as rat poison, in the bags of children because she was upset that older kids were trick-or-treating and she thought it should be for younger kids. But nobody was harmed, nobody was injured, and most of the modern day tradition of it has shifted from razor blades and needles to, well, now they're going to put fentanyl and they're going to put edible gummies, marijuana gummies in your bag. So you have to watch out for that. And again, most of those have been found to be hoax, exaggeration, but since the 1950s, the media every single year has ran with this story that be careful, don't trust anyone. You're more likely to get hit by a car on Halloween than you are to have tainted Halloween candy. But yet, there I was as a young kid standing at the hospital with my family waiting to get my Halloween candy x-rayed by the local hospital who was doing it. I mean, nothing ruins a spooky Halloween than hearing a nurse telling you don't dig into your bag of goodies until we've been able to run it through the x-ray machine because nothing's better than Halloween candy tainted with radiation.
And it's really too bad too, because, you know, I remember Halloween as a kid, you know, there was still people giving out things like popcorn balls and caramel apples and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that'll just never happen again. You know, it's because of this distrust of strangers that's been promoted so much. And a lot of this too kind of smacks as like, or has similarities to like the satanic panic, yes, of the 80s too. You know, these, you know, I guess we almost call them memes today. You know, these things that just take hold of societal's consciousness, and just everyone gets into a fervor and a panic over something that's just, you know, loosely based on nothing.
Yeah, I think that that kind of goes hand in hand with the backlash against Halloween that has always sort of been there as an undercurrent. Now, you know, much earlier in its history in this country, there were a lot of problems with it. But, you know, I mean, I can remember for years seeing in small rural papers every October rolls around, every year when it gets close to Halloween, there's some local, you know, evangelical or, you know, something that would have to write an op-ed and explain how Halloween is a satanic festival and there's going to be sacrifices and, you know, hide your children and all these types of things, all the fear mongering about it being associated with the devil. And again, no genuine knowledge about its actual origins, you know, where it came from, what its purpose is, what the purpose of a lot of the traditions are. So as the guys were saying, you know, this is one of the things that we're trying to, again, get out there, get the real information out to people before the actual lore is lost and replaced with, you know, some kind of, you know, fabricated nonsense.
I suppose when you were looking into that, did you come across the strange case that came from the UK by any chance, which is one of those things that it's perfectly linked, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the modern flaps at all?
No, tell us about it.
Is this a candy story?
It is. It is.
Oh, okay.
Poisoned candy. So October the 30th, 1858, in Bradford in Yorkshire, a contaminated batch of sweets were sold by a local market trader. 20 people died, 200 were hospitalized, and it turned out that when they were creating the sweets, they put the wrong ingredients in, and the wrong ingredient was arsenic.
Wow.
There was a big furore. They tried to pull all the sweets back. 3 people were taken to court, which was, I think, the market holder, the chemist and his assistant, but they were all acquitted because you couldn't blame anybody because it was a simple accident. They just used the wrong ingredients. The barrels weren't labeled correctly or something. And so they created this batch of poisonous sweets that went out. I mean, to be fair, only 20 people dying from arsenic ingestion is I suppose, it doesn't sound a good result, but it could have been a hell of a lot worse. But it changed the law in the UK about products, and after that, everything had to be labeled with all its ingredients, and things had to start being tested. But that's never linked with anything in the modern era. These flaps are all based probably on stories that originate in the US and Canada, that especially in this day and age, as you mentioned, David, a local paper might put it on their internet these days, their internet site. It'll travel the world. They've no idea how many people wherever would read that, or it'll get shared or something. And the next thing, you'll have a version that's been repackaged and changed for somewhere here in the UK. But hardly any of them ever refer back to one that was a Halloween flap, but it had no connection to Halloween and it had nothing to do with trick-or-treating, but it was a poisonous sweet outbreak.
Oh, go ahead, David.
Go ahead, Chad. I was going to say, see, Paul's giving us all these stories because he's hoping that Backroads Lore is going to invade the UK at some point and do an edition.
I'll be a roving UK reporter, chaps.
Here in America, it was the Tylenol poisonings that really shifted all of our brand stuff, where that was also when the candy producers really took it upon themselves to promote that they were sealed safe. You could trust it. Don't give out those nasty homemade popcorn balls or whatever else. Even giving away in the early days where people would give away coins or pencils or coupons for something or toys. Skip all that. Get right to the candy. And lo and behold, we have it for you in droves here. So the Tylenol scare here in America really move that shift from don't accept any homemade candy from someone. You have to have store-bought candies.
Well, and even still, you know, every year now in the U.S., you'll see lots of communities do these events called trunk or treat, where they'll have this event in a parking lot, typically of a church or a school, and it's you know, it's a bunch of vehicles with their trunks open and with the prepackaged candy so that the kids can go from car to car instead of door to door. And again, it's all rooted in that, you know, that whole wave of fear of, oh, going and knocking on the door of a stranger's house, because, you know, people don't know their communities as well as they used to. I mean, certainly when I grew up in a very rural area, and, you know, we knew who lived in most of the houses, and, you know, we knew which ones to hit up for the best candy or the best whatever, you know, whether it was a, you know, homemade treats and things like that, which sadly, as Kevin was saying, you know, we'll never really see that again. But even worse, you know, in some areas, we're getting away from the whole idea of even going door to door and trick or treating. People are trying to, you know, push back against that and say that that's not safe.
Yeah, it's this whole distrust of strangers has really, really become just a sad part of our culture. I mean, when I was a kid doing trick-or-treating, I mean, we would trick-or-treat until almost midnight. I mean, we would just go and not come home until we had trash bags full of candy. I mean, we would just go all over the place. Yeah. But now, you know, increasingly, trick-or-treating has official hours, and oftentimes it'll end before it's even dark out, which defeats the entire purpose of being out on Halloween night. I mean, when I was a kid, being out in the dark on Halloween night and seeing these glowing jack-o'-lanterns on people's doorsteps and not knowing what could be lurking out in the shadows on that one night of the year, I mean, that was a huge thrill for me, and I looked forward to it all year round, and it got my imagination just running. But like now, you know, if you have to be home before the sun goes down, and you can only go trick-or-treating on, you know, your street, and you have to have your parents with you, and, you know, all these restrictions that have been put on things and taken all the fun out of it, it's just a really sad comment on what our culture has become.
And the irony of trunk-or-treat, which I refuse to recognize, is that we're now saying Halloween is so dangerous that we're telling kids to go accept candy from a stranger's vehicle. Exactly what we were telling them not to do in the 80s and 90s. So, yeah, trunk or treat. If I'm ever trunk or treating, you guys can throw me in the trunk because, yes.
Maybe, Chad, maybe we should show up with a white paneled van.
A white, yeah, exactly.
You know, and like entice kids that way or something, just to
dressed as clowns. Get rid of that whole thing.
With free candy written on the side.
Exactly. Well, you know, and the other thing too is like, is so much is around convenience now. So like if Halloween doesn't land on a Friday or a Saturday night, you know, God forbid Halloween's on a school night, they'll just push trick-or-treating until the closest weekend for convenience sake, when it's not even on Halloween. I mean, that, again, defeats the whole purpose.
Yeah. We had a school here the other year tried to do that, and they got so much shade thrown at them, they very quickly got out of the way. Well, I've seen that, Kevin. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, like this year, it's on a Thursday here. There will be people out there who will be saying, oh, well, why can't it be on a Saturday? Because that's how calendars work.
Exactly. Exactly.
What's wrong with these people? I think we've got there is a very vocal minority these days, I think, when it comes to a lot of things like this. That those that shout loudest usually have the least to say. And things like that, they're just so idiotic. And yet people... They're the kind of things when you see them written down, you think, have you thought about that before you've written it? Because if you have, I'm even more concerned. It's just nonsensical, isn't it?
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
But it just ties into this, as you say, this whole sort of pulling away from knowing your community and knocking on doors and getting to know people. And I think a cynical person would suggest that some corporate entities love these kinds of don't accept homemade treats stories because they know that the kids are just going to have to buy loads of Haribo or gummy bears or whatever, or chocolate from their brand, because they know they're sealed and they're protected. Whereas the kindly people who love to make things for the local kids are basically out of pocket now because they've got to go down to the local supermarket or the mall and just fill up with processed chocolate for everybody.
Yeah, there's often a financial motivation behind these things when it comes down to it. But, you know, again, I mean, all of this stuff we're talking about, you know, it's really cool to have been able to put this kind of thing in this edition of Back Rows Lore. You know, Chad came up with this idea talking about, you know, this whole sort of myth or, you know, is there any truth behind tainted candy? And, you know, it turned out to just be an excellent article. And again, something that nobody has really approached in terms of, you know, how he's done it. We're talking about the effect essentially that it's having on these traditions every year of trick or treating and how it's evolved over time. And all of this stuff is, I think it's vital to kind of get this in one place. The Strange Harvest edition, I can tell you it's gotten a great response from people already. It's not even out yet, but people seem to be maybe the most excited about that one out of all the ones we've done so far.
Excellent, excellent. I'm sure everybody will be eagerly awaiting its release. Well, I think the last thing I should touch on before you all head off for your final weeks before the Van Meter Festival next weekend is how are you all looking forward to it? I mean, this festival seems to, ironically, have taken a life on its own. It seems to be going from strength to strength. Obviously, I've seen it grow over the last few years, and as with most festivals, there was COVID period that kind of knocked a few things sideways for a lot of them. But it seems that since things have sort of reverted to some variants of normality, this one, along with the Mothman Festival, people just seem to have really sort of engaged with it more sort of post-COVID.
I think you're right. I think there was a lot of pent-up demand because, you know, after the various lockdowns and social distancing, I think people were kind of just looking forward to getting out and having some semblance of back to normal, you know, getting out and rubbing elbows with people and meeting people and being among crowds and just kind of feeling that energy that you only get at a festival or a concert, you know, those kind of venues. And so I think that's why Mothman and the Van Meter Visitor Festival, you know, are drawing people out, you know, and they're not these kind of like stale academic conferences. You know, these are, I don't want to call it a party, but, you know, they're festive. You know, they have vendors, they have speakers, they have food, you know, people mill about and in a relaxed way and just have fun.
It's kind of funny for us too, thinking about it. And I don't know if Chad and Kevin had thought about this or not, but I actually, quite a few years ago, I spoke for the first time at the Van Meter event. And I think that was the first weekend we had sat and talked about working on a project together. And of course, you know, we, as I said earlier, we batted some ideas back and forth, and then COVID sort of put, you know, everybody in, you know, a strange state for a while and just kind of delayed a lot of things. And then it came back around and we started talking again, and eventually it all evolved into the Back Rows Lore publication. But it's become a really cool event for me in a lot of ways. I mean, these two guys are so instrumental in really the foundation of the festival, you know, because of having dug the legend up along with their friend Noah. But, you know, it's has taken on sort of a life of its own. And for me, seeing it evolve over the last several years, it's becoming something very unique. And I see so much potential there. I mean, it ultimately, I think eventually could be as big as Mothman. And honestly, there's no reason it couldn't be bigger because it's so close to a major city that, you know, and it's very central. So I noticed that there are a lot of people that are starting to gravitate towards the Van Meter Festival that can't necessarily afford to go all the way out to West Virginia for Mothman. Or maybe they don't want to deal with the crowds, you know, 10,000 people over the weekend. So they're looking for something smaller, but that still has that really cool energy and its own personality, so to speak. And that's certainly what Van Meter event's becoming.
I mean, Chad, are you delighted, surprised, impressed at how many people seem to have taken this strange story to their hearts? Because when I first came across it, which was after I'd spoken with yourself and Kevin the very first time when we talked about the Windio book that David had kindly sort of done my PR for me, and God bless you for that, David. Thank you, sir. It really does seem to have struck a chord with, because there are so many other festivals out there all over the US and Canada these days. I mean, you can't shift in the Pacific Northwest, it seems, over the summer for a Bigfoot festival here, there and everywhere. And yet we've got these lovely, quirky ones like Van Meter that seem to be not necessarily an antidote, but I think a refreshing change from the usual.
The legend is just so bizarre, so unbelievable, and so weird and interesting. It draws a lot of people's attention. And the fact that Van Meter is so small that it hasn't changed much from 1903. So when you're walking through the tour, the guided tours I do, you don't have to imagine what it was like for the bank manager to shoot out the front window at a monster, because we take you into the bank vault where you can see where they shot out the front window. You can walk to the old abandoned coal mine a couple blocks on the outskirts of town to see where they thought this thing was living. So I think that ability not only to have some of their best paranormal speakers there, like Kevin and David, but also that experience of literally following in the footsteps of the people of 1903 as they tried to extinguish this monster from their town. I think that hands-on experience of, and the fact that it's done on the closest weekend to when it actually occurred, on the anniversary. So all that comes together to just make it a truly fun and really weird festival. And believe it or not, many of the kids that come with their families, they want to do the nighttime walking tour rather than the safety of daylight.
I think what makes the Van Meter Visitor kind of unique among America's cryptids too is, you know, besides the fact that it's just a bizarro creature. I mean, this thing looked like it was 8 feet tall, looked like a pterodactyl with a glowing horn on its head, is it's just a big enigma. You know, it's this huge mystery. No one knows where it came from necessarily, what it wanted, what it was doing there, but it never attacked anyone. You know, it wasn't violent. No one was harmed. And so I think a lot of people look at it with almost like an endearing kind of attitude that, you know, I don't want to say they think it's like this, you know, cutesy cryptid, but I think it's because it's just so unknown and so bizarre that I think a lot of people kind of latch onto it, you know, versus like if something, you know, like the Beast of Bray Road, you know, which a lot of people say has, you know, more, scarier or more dangerous connotations because of the Dogman connection, or, you know, the Jersey Devil or something like that. You know, this, I don't want to say it's entirely benign, but it's this unknown factor that people just are curious about.
Yes. It's also famous for having one of the worst skeptical explanations ever on a television show, I think. when Chad appeared on Expedition X and they just said, oh yeah, everybody saw an owl. And I just thought, what? What do you mean?
Yeah, they may as well have just said it was a weather balloon.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, I know owls, you know, are responsible for everybody being terrified by everything, it would seem. I've lost count at how many sort of strange stories are dismissed as that the witnesses are all idiots and they don't know what an owl can do.
Yeah, well, that was one of the famous explanations for Mothman, too. There's a, you know, so-called expert who's a skeptic who went through a whole long, rambling explanation about how these people saw an owl. And, you know, just the more you listen to them, the more absurd it becomes. You know, I think some of these skeptics, I think they got a hold of some tainted Halloween candy that was... you know, maybe at Shaggy's house or something, they got special brownies, and that's where they come up with their scientific explanations from.
Yes. Yeah, I'm chuckling because I went to a UFO conference last weekend, and one of the speakers there also makes 3D models. So I bought myself a Hopkinsville Goblin from his range. He does a range of sort of strange UFO aliens as action figures, and obviously that's another one of the most famous skeptical dismissals of once again uneducated people from Kentucky being scared of owls.
Well, no. Now, the Hopkinsville case, which is some people have tried to claim it was Al's, but I absolutely love that case. I think I've always been very fascinated by it. But it has one of my favorite skeptical explanations from a it's been a long time since I looked at this. He was in the Air Force, but his explanation was that it was an escaped circus monkey that had been painted silver.
That it escaped from a train crash, David.
That's what everybody saw. So.
I don't know. So I suppose you've all spoken at it before. You've obviously got another Mothman aficionado, which is Steve Ward joining the lineup this year. And I think, is it Nash Hoover from Chasing Legends? Is it Nash's first appearance at the festival as well this year?
I believe that Nash spoke about six or seven years ago as well. Yeah.
We brought Steve in because he moves slower than the rest of us. So when the creature shows up, it's going to buy us all some extra time.
I don't suppose Joe's going down as well, is he, guys?
He is.
Oh, well, it's a race between Steve and Joe, it would seem then.
And, of course, we have Sean Engelman, who did the cover of our next Backroads Lore. He's going to be speaking there as well. So we just have a great variety of speakers, vendors, and again, those guided tours. So it really is a fun, unique, and I think a lot of people in Van Meter love the festival, even if they don't believe the legend.
Yeah.
They love the quirkiness of their own unique history, and they celebrate it every year with this fantastic conference.
And it's cheaper than going to a movie. You know, it's affordable for everyone.
Absolutely. And you've more chance of being attacked by a mysterious cryptid than going to the cinema as well, Kevin, which is always a bonus.
Exactly.
I suppose then, chaps, I'm going to ask the stupidest question in the world now to you three, especially. October's coming up. You've got Strange Harvest, and you've also got the special edition talking about what happened after 1903 in the Van Meter area and beyond, and some other intriguing and enticing collections and articles in that. No doubt you'll all be taking the next 3 months off and just relaxing, won't you?
I don't see that happening. We've got probably the next six or seven different themes of Backroads Lore already all mapped out and planned. So we've got our work cut out for us.
Yeah. Yeah, and on top of all your own original stuff as well, you guys, because you're very prolific, whether you're out chasing things down or you're writing new things, or David's continuing with his incredible State series. I mean, I'm just in awe the fact that you've managed to fit this in on top of everything else you're doing, and still making it of such a great quality with a rich focus on so many obscure things that we could miss out on, or intriguing situations like we're talking about the Tainted Candy that perhaps people in our field wouldn't sort of necessarily think would fit under the 14 umbrella, but it's a conspiracy and an urban myth. For me, it's prime fodder for 14 research, is it not?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I believe that it is. And you know, as cool as much work as this Backroads Lore project has been, I think it has energized us all in different ways. So, we all have other projects going on. I know both these guys are working on some books on their own. There's different projects in the midst of the whole Backroads Lore that's happening. So, I think it's pretty exciting. You're going to see even more stuff next year.
And the way that we're looking at Backroads Lore in general is we look at it as sort of an umbrella concept. So these volumes that we're publishing are just one facet or one aspect of Backroads Lore. So, you know, we've got all kinds of different things, you know, cooking in the background of different ways of expressing that as well.
So then, gentlemen, where can everybody get hold of the back issues, follow the work, and keep up to date and get hold of the next copy that's coming down the pipeline?
All the previous editions so far, well, let's see, volumes 1 through 3 are available on Amazon. but you can order them from us directly. You can check out Chad's website has a direct link. There's a link on my website to order them as well. And the, let's see, the special edition for Van Meter will drop at the festival, but it will also be live on Amazon this week sometime. So for people who want to pick that up who aren't able to attend the Van Meter event, Volume 4, Strange Harvest, will be shipping sometime in October. We do typically try to offer pre-sales, and people who purchase it ahead of time, they'll get signed editions and a lot of times a couple little cool bonuses in the package when we're able to send them out. Unfortunately, we can only send them domestically right now just because the costs are astronomical to ship overseas anymore. So yeah, all of those are available there. The Backroads Lore website should be back up and running again soon. And that's backroadslore.com. And then we're all on Facebook and social media and stuff. So, you know, anybody can feel free to drop us a message, or we'd love to hear feedback too from people who have been reading the volumes. You know, we'd like to know, you know, what you guys think and maybe even what you want to see. It doesn't mean that it'll end up in there, but you never know.
For me, Paul, Backroads Lore, I'm taking a little back seat for a little bit as I plot my 11th appearance on your show coming up in the near future. That's my main goal this Halloween season. Forget all the books, TV shows, lectures. I've got to buckle down and really figure out what topic I'm going to come back on your show for my record-breaking 11th appearance.
Well, I suppose finally then, obviously I'll put links into the show notes so everybody can get hold of a copy who doesn't have any of them so far. And I would recommend anybody who's interested in any weird and wonderful thing to get hold of them. They're brilliant. And I wasn't surprised at all at the quality of it with you three being involved. It's a testament to your abilities as both researchers and writers that they're damn fine. And I can't wait to see how this continues to grow and develop over the forthcoming years, let's hope, and as long as it may continue. I just want to check lastly, I mean, when I spoke with Kevin, he's already advised me what he likes to do at Halloween, so I wouldn't firstly like to say, Kevin, have you got your room booked for this Halloween already?
I do, yep. So staying at as usual, staying at a haunted hotel over Halloween with some other researchers. We've been doing this for well over a decade. Every Halloween, it's kind of a tradition that we do. So yeah, it's all ready to go.
Brilliant. So David, Chad, do you do anything specifically on Halloween? Me personally, I usually answer the door till 9 o'clock when they stop knocking and then watch a couple of scary films. That's as exciting as I get here. What about you two? Do you do anything with your families, or do you do anything specifically, or do you just like to just take the night off because you're spooky 364 days of the year anyway?
Go ahead, Chad.
Well, I'm definitely celebrating Halloween. I'll be lecturing during the day and causing chaos at night. But I'm also a big proponent of Mischief Night, the night before Halloween, of getting out there playing some pranks, also known as Devil's Night. I love being out there because the streets are empty. You have full rein for any pranks or tricks you'd like to incorporate. So I like to spread it out, not just Halloween, but I'm starting the night before.
Yeah, I mean, I love this season. And for me, I kind of am celebrating it all month long. So, you know, it's kind of different every year. I usually try to enjoy the holiday as much as I can. And, you know, sometimes that means doing something really unique. I usually try to do some legend chirping right around that time because you can have some interesting experiences, I think, on a Halloween night. You know, it's that very liminal time. But, you know, beyond that, of course, you have to juggle schedules and everything else. And I'm kind of all over the place for the last half of October and a good bit of November. So I'm not even entirely sure where I'm going to be yet, to tell you the truth, because of how some different travels and everything have been added in. So, but yeah, I always make a point of trying to enjoy it.
Brilliant. Well, gentlemen, first and foremost, thank you both. I nearly said thank you both there. There's three of you. Thank you all for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. Kevin, David, especially, because I've not spoke to you for a while. I know how busy you all are. And I just want to say congratulations on a brilliant body of work. You've really spoiled us weirdos this year with your releases. And I look forward to everything else you all do. And I look forward to the next time I speak to all of you, be it all together or individually. I hope you all take care. And thank you again, as always, for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Keep an eye out.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.